Hi everyone, my name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hey, David.
Thank you for coming out on this Memorial Day. I'm sure that it was the rain that drove you here as opposed to the opportunity to have a barbecue, but thank you. It's interesting. When you think about Towives and Bill's process in drafting the original manuscript, he asked Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, to write it, and she actually turned him down on the opportunity, which is kind of interesting. Ann Smith used to sit at her house. She was a homemaker, and Dr. Bob was, the breadwinner. And she would sit there, and men would come by looking for Dr. Bob, and she would say, "Well, he's not here right now, but if you'd like, we can sit here, have some coffee," and she'd read from the Bible with him. And she was so totally ingrained with the idea of the Oxford Group, which is that it's a family affair. That recovery comes in all aspects of our lives. They really were the people who kind of practice the Oxford Group. And it's always, in my mind, it's always a shame what ended up happening with them. But, she was a real stalwart kind of supporter of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, she doesn't get a lot of credit. You don't hear people talk about, let's have an Ann Smith, day here in Alcoholics Anonymous. But, what she did for Alcoholics Anonymous, certainly in the Akron area, is, I think, very influential. She kept guys around for Dr. Bob to come home. And she turned down Bill for writing the thing. And I think that he had asked her, and I'm only guessing now, you can certainly do some work yourself, that he asked her because she was so active, because she was so influential, because she was so giving of her time to members. And if you ever get a chance to go to Akron to the Founders Day, I think it's in June, right?
It's coming up in a couple of weeks.
You're speaking, aren't you? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you want to go to Founders Day, just travel out there and harass Chris. But also, go to Dr. Bob's house. It's it's owned now by a charity, and you can go into the kitchen. I have a picture of me with this giant coffee pot. The coffee pot on their table was huge, so I guess they had a lot of people stop by. But he didn't ask Lois, right? He didn't ask his wife to write it. And I'm not sure why that is. I can only speculate because she was the breadwinner in the family, and she wasn't working with others as much as Ann Smith was, so he decided to write it himself. And even given all this, I think in some ways when I read through this original manuscript version, I can see that, he felt, a real obligation to his wife. And I want to say that he wrote in the family Bible three times a pledge to Lois, "I'm going to stop drinking right now." That didn't ever work for him. Right? And I think that when he finally kind of saw that Alcoholics Anonymous was working and he was staying sober, he wanted to kind of honor that thing. So that was something, the women of Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, it's important to recognize. And there were a lot of them over the years who really helped us. Henrietta at Cyberling was the one who introduced, Bill Wilson to Dr. Bob. Without her, we wouldn't have Alcoholics Anonymous. So Two Wives, an important chapter that I've overlooked as much as I possibly could. With few exceptions, our book thus far has spoken of men. But what we have said applies quite as much to women. Our activities in behalf of women who drink are on the increase. There is every evidence that women regain their health as readily as men if they follow our suggestions. But for every man who drinks, others are involved. The wife who trembles in fear of the next debauch, the mother and father who see their son wasting away. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I remember about 2 years before the end, being at that place, have you ever said to yourself, I don't have the ability to control my drinking? 2 years, my life still looked somewhat okay. 2 years before the end, kind of like I still had, I wasn't yellow from jaundice, I didn't lose control of my bodily functions at functions. But I remember going back to my mom's house, and I remember standing there on a beautiful spring day and saying to myself, I don't have the ability to say no. I don't have the ability to when I'm saying no, I'm actually reaching for a drink. Right? My hand is actually not listening to my brain. Now, what I'm thinking about at that moment is, boy, I'm really not in control of this ride anymore. And I remember saying to myself, the phrase I use for myself is, I'm going to ride this roller coaster to the end and see where it's taking me. What I had no idea and had no ability to kind of look at was, what was the impact on my mother? What was the impact on my family? Right? What were the impact on the people who loved me? when they saw what was going on with me. You know, I would disappear for long periods of time, and I would only show up when I looked what I thought was good. But the truth of the matter was, right, I wasn't so good. Now, if you fast forward into after I went back out, but wasn't going back to meetings, but I was dry, you know, the wife didn't necessarily tremble, right, at the next debauch, but nobody really wanted to see me when I came home. For 2 years as a dry alcoholic, when I would roll through the door, people didn't want to see me because I had all the mannerisms, activities, mindset of the active alcoholic, right? I was irritable and discontent. You know, I was a prey to misery, right? You go right through the bedevilments. That was me on a daily basis, totally dry, right? I don't understand the impact I have on your life. I don't understand what it looks like, right? We have two employers, but how about two employees? I had people working for me, right? And I was a prey to misery and depression. So when they pissed me off, I would do something, right? If they didn't treat me right, I would do something. You know, so this idea of fear that kind of comes from the next debauch, I can have a spree without drinking, right? I can go on an anger spree. You ever had one of those moments where you go, I'm going to fix his little red wagon, right? And you spend like 2 hours like in this adrenaline fuel. I'm going to somehow fix that stuff, right? Anger, right? Among us are wives, relatives, and friends whose problems has been solved, as well as some who have not yet found a happy solution. We shall let the wives of Alcoholics Anonymous address the wives of men who drink too much. What they say will apply to nearly everyone bound by ties of blood or affection to an alcoholic. And one of the things that I realized, and this literally took me about 5 years after coming into the rooms, was just how far this thing spread. And it was something that I didn't want to look at for years, and I wasn't really able to look at for years. You know, how did I affect my parents? How did I affect my friends? How did this stuff look like? You know, my mom started treating other people differently because of how I acted at home. Right? What I brought to the table changed other people's opinion because they desperately wanted to fix me and they couldn't fix me. And I would promise them whatever they wanted to hear, but they wouldn't, you know, they couldn't believe. So what ends up happening is when your son, right, or your husband is promising you on a daily basis that things will change, and then they don't, in fact, they are getting worse, what's the most natural, normal reaction I'm going to have if that's happening to me? I'm going to stop trusting people around me because my whole view of the world starts to shift. That person who I love and they're supposed to love me is supposed to honor their word to me, right? How did Lois feel when those promises got wrote in the Bible, that family Bible, and Bill didn't? He went out on his next, you know, spree. How does that affect me? How far out does that stain spread? Right? When I am causing you discontent and discomfort in what should be a very close relationship, how do you show up at work that next day? How do you show up for somebody else who you love, right? The rational, normal person, and I've seen this in people, compartmentalize me, right? Until they can't, you know, and they don't really let it affect other relationships. But the average person, right, finds themselves lashing out at people because they can't lash out at me because they're afraid of what I'm going to do. Right, so all of a sudden they're impacting other people in their life. Now what happens to those people who don't understand why they're being lashed out about it? Now this idea of alcoholism and the problem that I faced when I rolled through stories, it's all about me. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem, right? You ever read, my first sponsor made me read that every day. I wanted to slap him. I said, it's not about me, it's them. You should see what they did, right? But the truth of the matter is, that it took about 5 years in these rooms before I started to actually look at how I had spread out, a stain of my actions had spread out. People who I partied with that would go on after I got sober, right, to die, right? Those parents, those husbands, those wives, they didn't think very highly of me, right? They didn't know whether I had a contributing factor or not, right? And for them, right, they saw me sober, and I'm okay now in their minds, right? But they've lost a loved one. How far out do the things that I do impact others? The funny thing was, you know, when I started to actually read the Big Book, I started to understand just how desperate my situation was, just how desperately I needed to get to a place where I was actually trying to be altruistic, right? Something that I probably will never be able to do properly or fully, right? And to seek to be of service to God and my fellow man, because I've also found that that travels, right? That travels through relationships. When I'm nice to somebody else, when I take the time to be with somebody else and spend some time, when I try to help other people, not something that's not something that comes naturally because I don't like people, right? People are annoying. They're inconvenient, right, Chris?
Yeah, they're inconvenient. Yeah,
they're inconvenient. When I actually take time with somebody and honestly want to be helpful, that travels too. They learn that that has to be paid forward too. It's not because I have any power to explain that to them. It's just because I'm doing what has been done for me from the very beginning. I didn't start paying this back for years, right? The gift of what comes to me, right, or comes to us, right, is love and service, like Dr. Bob said, you know, in his last talk in 1950, or his last recorded talk, I guess, in 1950, at the world, the first international convention. You know, and boiled down to the last, it's this program was about love and service, right? But I walked in here thinking I was supposed to get something. You ever go to a meeting and say, hey, I got some stuff at that meeting. That was a good meeting. Right? I used to say that all the time. Any judgment involved in that? Right? Any selfishness involved in that? I learned from Chris and from other men in my life and women in my life that the idea is, what did I bring today to the table? What did I bring into the meeting? What did I bring to my family? What did I bring to the people I work with? What do I bring to a classroom? Because I'm a student again. What do I bring into this world? It's so easy for me to see this as a what do I get out of this world? And it's funny, when you really start to shift your view to, like, what can I bring to the table, you begin to get a different view onto, like, what other people who show up in these rooms or at work, you know? America, you know, it seems to be, you know, all about me at times. Yeah, not saying, like, any particular show like Kim Kardashian is all about her, right? And that's not a bad thing, right? That's just what we consume from advertising. But the truth of the matter is that the only way that I can ever get free of self is to actually get free of self, which means putting you guys in the front row, right? It's such an awkward place, and it doesn't make any sense when I'm trying to get recovered, because I thought I had to do something for me to get somewhere else. But in fact, I have to stop doing for me. The guy who lacks power has to stop trying to execute on power and has to move out to start doing things for others.
Chris Alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
Thanks, Dave. Dave was talking about Ann Smith. Ann Smith bought into the Oxford Group to the point where she was doing the morning meditations, the evening reviews, all the prayer work, all the fellowshipping, and that really was the catalyst for Bill and Bob when Bill showed up in Akron, trying to hustle the tire company out from under some people's hands with the proxy battle. He gets stuck at Dr. Bob's house for a couple of months, I think it was. And Ann Smith had this practice, the morning meditation. Come on down, let's do this morning meditation. Hey, you know, evening review, fellowship, a lot of Christianity, a lot of applied Christianity. So really, you know, the 12 steps were in the back of Bill's mind prior to this, but a lot of the spirituality and the cohesiveness to these steps were hammered out by Ann, and it was only later years where Bill really admitted this and, you know, called Ann a co-founder. But another thing to put into context is the fact that divorces were much more rare in the 30s than they are today. I think if you get married today, I think your chances of getting divorced are somewhere around 50%, right? You know, somewhere around
that's my personal history.
That's your personal history. Mine's like 75%, but, you know, we won't go there. So there was more like, I'm done. But back in the 30s, I mean, people hung in there. They hung in there. And you have to put that into context, too, because this chapter is laid out for people who've quite possibly hung in there a long time. And there was a lot of misunderstanding about alcoholism. Another point that Bill wanted to make in this chapter, and understand, he's about to say, as wives of alcoholics, pretending he's a wife, one of the points he wanted to make was that the alcoholic was ill. He wasn't bad. And you should not treat them like they're bad. You should treat them like they're ill. And something like that is a revolutionary concept. When you've been living with an alcoholic for 20 years or something, that's a revolutionary concept. But I'll start reading. As wives of alcoholics, we want you to sense that we understand you as perhaps few can. We want to analyze mistakes we have made and help you to avoid them. We want to leave you with the feeling that no situation is too difficult and no unhappiness too great to overcome. We've traveled a rocky road. There is no mistake about that. We have had long rendezvous with hurt pride, frustration, self-pity, misunderstanding, and fear. These are not pleasant companions. We have been driven to maudlin sympathy, to bitter resentment. We have veered from extreme to extreme, ever hoping that one day our loved ones would be themselves once more. Our loyalty and the desire that our husbands hold up their heads and be like other men have begotten all sorts of predicaments. We have been unselfish and self-sacrificing. We have told innumerable lies to protect our pride and our husbands' reputations. We have prayed, we have begged, we have been patient. We have struck out viciously. We have run away. We have been hysterical. We have been terror-stricken. We have sought sympathy. We have had retaliatory love affairs with other men. Our homes have been battlegrounds many an evening. In the morning, we have kissed and made up. Our friends have counseled chucking the men, and we have done so with finality, only to be back in a little while, hoping, always hoping. Our men have sworn great solemn oaths that they were through drinking forever. We have believed them when no one else could or would. Then in days, weeks, or months, a fresh outburst. We seldom had friends at our homes, never knowing how or when the men of the house would appear. We could make few social engagements. We came to live almost alone, unwanted by anyone. Then we were invited out. When we were invited out, our husbands always sneaked so many drinks that they spoiled the occasion. If, on the other hand, they took nothing, their self-pity made them killjoys. There was never financial security. Positions were always in jeopardy or gone. An armored car could not have brought home the pay envelope. The checking account melted like snow in June. There were other women. How heartbreaking was this discovery? How cruel to be told that they understood our men as we did not. The bill collectors, the sheriffs, the angry taxi drivers. I love that. Angry taxi drivers are showing up. The policemen, the bums, the pals, even the ladies he brought home. Our husband thought we were so inhospitable. Joy killer, nag, wet blanket. That's what they said. Next day, they would be themselves again, and we would forgive and try to forget. We've tried to hold the love of our children for their father. We have told small tots their father was sick, which was much nearer the truth than we realized. They struck the children. They kicked out door panels. It's crazy that they know that I used to kick out door panels, Dave. If I was locked out of a house or something and it was inconvenient, I knew how to kick the door panel out. Smashed treasured crockery and ripped the keys out of a piano. This is the only thing in this book that I've not done. I've yet to rip the keys out of a piano. Dave, you've probably done that, though.
No, then it wouldn't let me.
You're worse than me. In the midst of such pandemonium, they may have rushed out, threatening to live with the other woman forever. In desperation, we've got tight ourselves, the drunk to end all drunks. The unexpected result was that our husbands seemed to like it. Perhaps at this point we got a divorce and took the children home to father and mother. Then we were severely criticized by our husbands' parents for desertion. Usually we did not leave. We stayed on and on. We finally sought employment ourselves as destitution faced us and our families. We began to ask medical advice as the sprees got closer together. The alarming physical and mental symptoms, the deepening pall of remorse, depression, and inferiority that settled down on our loved ones. These things terrified and distracted us. As animals on a treadmill, we have patiently and wearily climbed, falling back in exhaustion after each futile effort to reach solid ground. Most of us had entered the final stage with its commitment to health resorts, sanitariums, hospitals, and jails. And today it's basically rehabs, detoxes, halfway houses, and therapeutic communities. Sometimes there were screaming delirium and insanity. Death was often near. Under these conditions, we naturally made mistakes. Some of them rose out of ignorance of alcoholism. Sometimes we sensed dimly that we were dealing with sick men, but we fully had we fully understood the nature of the alcoholic illness, we might have behaved differently. Again, this is asking the wives to shift their perspective. It is not fun living with people like us. There was an event about 5 years ago in New York City. It was the Gotham Roundup, and there was about 600 people there. Okay, and this woman, Katie Parker, gets up, and there's 600 people, and she's talking about step 9 or something, and she wanted to take a sense of how we all were with relationships, because step 9 is a lot about relationships. So she goes, Would everyone in here who is married please raise their hands? And out of 600 people, about 30 people raised their hands. Now, think about this. The statistic, again, for adults is about 50% of us are married. So right there, there's an enormous issue, right? There's only 30 out of 600. What is that, 5%, Dave? You're the math guy. It's not much.
A little under 10.
Okay. So she then goes, has anyone in here ever been married but have gotten divorced? And about 400 hands went up. And then she asks, has anybody in here been married and divorced more than once? And almost the same amount of hands went up. And then she said, everybody in here that's been married and divorced at least 3 times, raise your hand. And I swear to God, 200 hands went up. Now imagine how difficult it is to live with an active alcoholic. You got to understand that we don't pick up on this, because alcoholism is an illness of perspective. It's an illness of perception. And our whole worldview is based on selfishness and self-centeredness. So we don't see that the people we're married to are going through hell. We think they're disloyal, or they're nagging us, or why don't they just get off our back and everything would be fine, you know? So we are very, very difficult to live with. It wasn't long after the formation of Alcoholics Anonymous that they formed Al-Anon, because chronic proximity to alcoholics makes people ill. And I'll give you something from my own personal experience. I met and married the person that I'm married to now. I don't call her my current wife because it makes her pissed. But I married when I was 20 years sober. I met and married somebody that I knew back when I was young. And we're perfect for each other in a lot of different ways. She's a normal person. You know, didn't have therapy, didn't, you know, have issues, you know. She was a hospice nurse, and you know, was making a good living, and was really, you know, taking care of her kids. She was divorced, but she was taking care of her kids and doing all the right things. Really family oriented, very, very healthy. very healthy woman. So she meets up with me, and within 3 years, it's time for Al-Anon. Because she needed some extra help dealing with me. And listen, I'm a step working, recovering guy. You know, I'm all about practicing these principles. But we're difficult to live with because the basis of our worldview comes from selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, it does not come from being compassionate and collaborative and all that other stuff. It comes from, how is this going to affect me? So, so I think it's very, very important for people who love alcoholics. And believe me, just because we're assholes doesn't mean we're not lovable. We're interesting. We're funny. It's like dinner and a show, you know, when you hang out with us. And there's a lot of people that want to be with alcoholics. They'll go from one alcoholic to another, you know. And there's a reason for that. We're very, very interesting people, but there's some stuff that you have to understand if you're going to be with an alcoholic, and a lot of that is laid out in this particular chapter. Now, I'm about 4 years into my marriage. And my wife is having issues with me. I mean, I can't do anything right. I can't put a dish away. I can't park a car right. I put the wrong clothes on all the time. I mean, I'm getting pissed because, you know, I'm an adult. I don't need somebody micromanaging everything that I do. You know what I mean? So we're in conflict. Luckily, she does the right thing. She gets an Al-Anon sponsor. She starts going through the steps with an Al-Anon sponsor. And guess what? I'm not so much of an asshole anymore. It's magic. You know what I mean? So, and listen, I'm working a program. She's working a program. Everything is cool. You know, I'm not working a program and she's working a program and it's not going to work. I'm working a program and she's not working a program. It's just not going to work unless you happen to have someone so damn healthy, you know. And that's just not, those aren't the ones that are attracted to us. You know what I mean? It's usually the ones that need a little bit of help. How could men who love their wives and children be so unthinking? You got to understand, like, in my first marriage and the aftermath of that, because it was 12 of the happiest months of my life, okay, that first marriage. You know, I had a daughter, and here is what I would do. She'd be about 4 years old, you know, and I loved her more than anything in the world. You have no idea. I mean, when a child is that small and it's your only child and, you know, the rest of your life kind of sucks, you focus in on that innocence and that unconditional love that they have. And there's nothing more important to you in the world. And that's where I am, right? And I'd be drunk or something, or I'd be hungover or whatever, and I'd go, you know, Danielle, tomorrow, you know what Daddy's going to do? Daddy's going to take you to the zoo. You know, and I meant it. Like if you would have put a lie detector on me, are you going to take her to the zoo tomorrow? You're damn right I'm going to take her to the zoo tomorrow. But I would get drunk that night, and I would come to the next morning, and I'd be ill like a bastard, and I'd have to start drinking again. And I'd have to sit there and look her in the face and say, let's go to the zoo, Daddy. Let's go to the zoo. We're going to the zoo. And I'd have to look at her, and I'd have to say, sweetheart, Daddy's sick today. We can't go to the zoo. And I'd have to break her heart. Now, do you think I wanted to do that? There's not a fiber in my spiritual being that wanted to do that. I was caught up in alcoholism, and alcoholism is a lot more powerful than the love of your children. It's a lot more powerful than anything else in your life. You are going to make choices to keep alcoholism going. And you're not going to have power, choice, and control to not do that. And that looks like you're a huge asshole. It just does. It looks like you're a liar. it looks like you're it looks like you have no love. It looks like you're a bad father, and it looks like all of that, right? What it is it's an illness. It's alcoholism. That's not how we would behave if we weren't ill. So this chapter is trying to shift our perspective so that we'll look on people that are sick with compassion. I got to tell you, there's a lot of spiritual principles in the four chapters after working with others. And the spiritual principles in this chapter, we can actually apply across the board. And we can apply them by having a compassionate perspective on other people. Certainly, I've learned a lot about how to handle sponsees and people, you know, people in the AA groups who are really still sick and suffering, you know, and family members who are involved. It's really rough. Now, I'll give you another example of some of the spiritual principles and how I was able to apply them today. Okay. Now, my wife's sister has a daughter. She's 17, and she's hooked up with the wrong people, and she's been doing drugs, and who the hell knows what's in her goddamn Juul, you know, those things all those kids smoke, and, you know, she's getting STDs, and she's out, like, you know, with these guys that are, it's a mess, right? And the whole family is absolutely nuts. Well, I make the recommendation that she put her daughter in a place called Newport Academy. Newport Academy is a treatment center for adolescents. And what they do is they collaborate with your school teachers, their school teachers, and they teach the courses that you're getting at your high school so that when you come back, you haven't missed anything. And it's a really, really fine place. It's a fine place. And it's a 90-day program. Well, much to my wife's chagrin and my chagrin, 60 days comes, and she wants to come home to go to prom. Because there's prom, right? I mean, you don't want to miss prom. Oh, my God, if you miss prom. I missed prom a couple of times. That's why I'm acting like. So anyway, it's a big deal. She puts the pressure on her mom. You know, I'm doing really good. Well, the thing I know about Newport Academy is get your head out of your ass is the first month, crack you open like an egg the second month, and you look at all the stuff. And the third month is you get put back together, okay? So if you get cracked open like an egg and you get sent home to a sick household, you're in deep shit. And my wife knows this, and I know this, but the pressure on this family to let this daughter come home so she can go to prom was too much for them, so they pulled her out, and they brought her home for prom. Now my wife is pissed, because this could be a life and death error. You know what I mean? It really could. But what actually can we do? We're dealing with someone who's not recovered. We're dealing with a family that doesn't understand the nature of addiction. And also, month three is family month, right? So a lot of stuff's been missed. But do we get mad? If we get mad, we're not going to be able to be helpful. If we tell them that they're complete morons and their daughter is going to die because of their mistake, we're not going to be in a place where we can be helpful. So we had this conversation and we said, okay, what's done is done. Let's try to be collaborative. Let's try to find the young people's meetings. Let's try to be constructive in this instance. Because we're not dealing with bad people. We're not dealing with stupid people. We're dealing with people that are ill. And listen, family systems are ill too. You know, please understand that a lot of family systems are real. There's also really good families that have drug addict kids, you know, but a lot of times the whole family, you know, needs to reevaluate, you know, their priorities and their perspective. And even if they did not love their families, how could they be so blind about themselves? What had become of their judgment, their common sense, their willpower? How could they not see that drink meant ruin to them? Why was it when we pointed out these dangers that they agreed and then got drunk again immediately? Well, there's a reason. There's a reason. We mean it with every fiber of our being. When we've just gone through a jackpot, we've just got another DUI, we're out of the house and the suitcase and the clothes are all over the front lawn. We mean it with every fiber of our being that we're done now. We're done for good. You can count on us. But what we're doing is we're making promises we can't keep because we're not in control. Power, choice, and control are not accessible to us. We cannot make the decision to not drink or not drug. It's not available to us. But we think it is, and we make all these promises, and then we disappoint one more time. You know, this chapter is explaining this to the family so that they kind of understand what they're up against. They're up against alcoholism. These are some of the questions which race through the mind of every girl who has an alcoholic husband. We hope our book has answered some of them. But now you will have seen that perhaps your husband has been living in that strange world of alcoholism where everything is distorted and exaggerated. You can see that he really does love you with his better self. Of course, there is such a thing as incompatibility, but in nearly every instance, the alcoholic only seems to be unloving and inconsiderate. It is usually because he is warped and sickened that he says and does these appalling things. Today, most of our men are better husbands and fathers than ever before. Don't condemn your alcoholic husband, no matter what he says or does. He is just another very sick, unreasonable person. Treat him, when you can, as though he had pneumonia. When he angers you, remember that he is very ill. Here's a story for you. There's this alcoholic, and he's living in this family, and he's the breadwinner, and he's the big family guy, and he comes home, and the kids don't know what dad is going to come in the house. It could be dad that's going to beat the shit out of you. It could be dad that's bringing presents. Nobody knows. Everything's in turmoil. But when he comes home, he gets in an argument with his wife, usually, right, if he's been drinking. So they yell, and they scream, and they yell, and they scream, and what this guy does is he falls down on the floor, and he acts like he's having a heart attack. And he holds his heart. Oh, I'm having a heart attack. And everything stops. And everybody now is, Daddy, Daddy, are you all right? Daddy, are you all right? And it calms like the whole situation down. And he's used this time after time after time. Okay. The wife starts going to Al-Anon, gets an Al-Anon sponsor, goes through the steps with her Al-Anon sponsor. And the husband comes home drunk. There's all kinds of words with the family. He falls down on the floor. He's having his normal heart attack. And the wife pulls out the vacuum and vacuums around him. Now, that's a better response than buying into the turmoil. And you do learn that from Al-Anon.